TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. What makes our lights go on? The epic struggle over dams, displaced people, and the environment. This is the subtitle of a recent book by Jacques Leslie, a foreign correspondent turned nonfiction writer who once covered the war on Vietnam for the LA Times. When Jacques Leslie did a cover story for Harper's Magazine entitled Running Dry, What Happens When the World No Longer Has Enough Fresh Water, he began a lasting involvement with the environmental and political issues of water. What Jacques Leslie discovered when he wrote for Harper's was that, quote, at the core of every argument about water are dams, the modern pyramids, generators of extravagantly apportioned electricity, water storage, and environmental and social disasters. Some dams are so huge that they can be seen from space. Millions of people have been displaced and some of the most fertile land been drowned. In spite of their size, dams are not forever. Sooner or later, they will all silt up and become expensive waterfalls. They pose a constant looming danger to life downstream when they fall into disrepair or are damaged by earthquakes or acts of war. Nevertheless, the building of large dams continues, much of it promoted and funded by the World Bank. Here is Jacques Leslie. He begins by reading about the 1935 dedication of the Hoover Dam in Nevada, near Las Vegas.
At Hoover's September 30, 1935 dedication, Interior Secretary Harold Ickes exactly reflected the common understanding when he declared, pridefully, man acclaims his conquest of nature. Hoover's image became one of the nation's most popular exports. After it, every country wanted dams, and every major country, regardless of ideology, built them. Between Hoover and the end of the century, more than 45,000 large dams, dams at least five stories tall, were built in 140 countries. By now, the planet has expended $2 trillion on dams, the equivalent of the entire 2003 U.S. government budget. The world's dams have shifted so much weight that geophysicists believe they have slightly altered the speed of the Earth's rotation, the tilt of its axis, and the shape of its gravitational field. They adorn 60% of the world's 200-plus major river basins, and the water behind them blots out a terrain bigger than California. Their turbines generate a fifth of the world's electricity supply, and the water they store makes possible as much as a sixth of the Earth's food production. Take away Hoover Dam, and you take away a bearing, a confidence, a sense of what nations are for. Yet in a sense, that's what's happening. Even if Hoover lasts another 1,100 years, by which time Bureau of Reclamation officials say Lake Mead will be filled with sediment, turning the dam into an expensive waterfall, its teleological edifice has already begun to crumble. In seven decades, we have learned that if you take away Hoover, you also take away millions of tons of salt that the Colorado once carried to the sea, but that have instead been strewn across the irrigated landscape, slowly poisoning the soil. Take away the Colorado River dams and you return the silt gathering behind them to a free-flowing river, allowing it again to enrich the downstream wetlands and the once fantastically abundant, now often caked, arid, and refuse-fouled delta. Take away the dams and the Cocopa Indians, whose ancestors fished and farmed the delta for more than a millennium, might have a chance of avoiding cultural extinction. Take away the dams, and the Colorado would again bring its nutrients to the Gulf of California, helping that depleted fishery to recover the status it held a half century ago as an unparalleled repository of marine life. Take away the dams, finally, and the Colorado River returns to its virgin state, tempestuous, fickle, in some stretches, astonishing. Now, it happened when I began to look into writing a book about dams that there was in existence something called the World Commission on Dams. This was formed by the World Bank in the mid-1990s out of its frustration in building dams. Indeed, they had run into so much opposition on some of their biggest projects that they'd been forced to pull out of a project for the first time in their history. And they were growing increasingly frustrated, even desperate, to figure out a way to cut through this opposition. The opponents had been calling for quite a long time for the creation of an independent commission that would study all of the dams bank projects, come to some conclusions about their benefits, their detriments, and then make recommendations on how they ought to be built in the future. And finally, the bank said, all right, let's create this independent commission. It made one interesting caveat, however, and that was that instead of simply studying the bank's dams, it would study all large dams, all 45,000 dams, the idea apparently being to divert attention from the many fiascos that the dam had sponsored. The opponents were happy to agree to the formation of such a commission because they believed that an honest study would confirm what they'd been saying about dams. And so this commission was formed. People were nominated for the 12 commissioner positions, and they were divided into three groups. There were four people who were going to be anti-dam, four who were in the middle, and four who were pro-dam. And indeed, the commission was formed and it was chosen that way. It met for 2.5 years. It oversaw the most thorough study of dams that has ever been done. Its final report was issued in November 2000. It was remarkably critical of dams, given the composition of the commission. And it made 26 recommendations for how they ought to be built in the future. They were so rigorous that the bank took one look at these recommendations and turned its back on its own creation, said, never mind, and has since then gone back to a policy of building as many large dams as quickly as it can. For a writer, however, the commission had a benefit, and that was that I borrowed its structure. I decided to write about one person from each of those three groups, one pro-dam, one in the middle, one anti-dam. In India, I wrote about a woman named Medha Patkar, who is considered the world's foremost anti-dam activist, a woman who has fought against the Sardar Sarovar Dam, this monstrous dam, by some measures the second or third largest dam in the world, on the Narmada River in western India. She started a group called the Narmada Bachao Andolan, or the Save the Narmada movement, in the late 1980s, then proceeded to go on hunger strikes of 17, 20, 22, and 26 days, coming right up to the edge of losing her life in her opposition to this dam. She also tried drowning herself in rising reservoir water. At one point, the water reached right here when the Indian police pulled her out to save the Indian government the embarrassment of her death. And she was an absolutely extraordinary person to spend time with, as I did. I also wrote about an anthropologist now retired from the California Institute of Technology named Thayer Scudder, who's considered the world's leading authority on dam resettlement. He has done most of his work in southern Africa, so we went together to a number of projects there. And finally, I wrote about Don Blackmore, the manager of the only major river system in Australia. He is in a commission that manages it. And although he certainly is not opposed to the idea of dams, he found that his job during the 14 years of his tenure consisted of trying to persuade farmers and politicians that they'd taken too much water out of this river. Indeed, its flow is now a little over a quarter of what it was before there were dams and other diversions. And as a result, the river is dying, and so are large tracts of land along the river in quite devastating ways. So first, let me read you a passage about Medha Patkar. I first saw her at something called the World Water Forum, which was organized by the World Bank. This was in 2000 in The Hague. And she was appearing there with Arundhati Roy, who many of you probably know, a writer who won the Booker Prize for The God of Small Things and has been a great supporter of MEDA, and in fact gave the money that she won in that award to MEDA's organization. MEDA was formal, ideological, impersonal, and unceasingly serious. She said privatization didn't acknowledge the contribution of local people, the people who tended the forest and got displaced by dams because they weren't investors. She said privatization rewarded cash crops, which meant that poor people who depended on subsistence agriculture went hungry. Nearly yelling, she said, states now are puppets of the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. It wasn't until a year later, when I spent a month in Cape Town, the headquarters of the World Commission on Dams, that I began to suspect I'd gotten things backward. The Commission Secretariat members were mostly water experts, few of whom believed that the dam debate was as one-sided as MEDA did, and they weren't noted particularly for humility or guilelessness. Yet they spoke about MEDA with awe, a hint of reverence, as if simultaneously acknowledging her stature and vulnerability. Everyone called her by her first name. Even the engineers and capitalists across the ideological abyss, who are as enthusiastically pro-dam as anti, treated her gently. It was understandable, they said, that MEDA would fight for displaced people, but their plight did not invalidate dams. Most people spoke of her toughness, her determination, her willingness to suffer. I learned that MEDA declined to eat her meals during a flight to a commission meeting in Cairo and gave the food to Cairo's street children after disembarking. I was told that MEDA attended one commission session immediately after a week-long hunger strike and threw up everything she ate. A staff member eventually found her some plain yogurt, which she kept down. And I was told that during the heated last weeks of negotiations over the commission's final report, MEDA was the only commissioner who won as the price of her signature the placement of an individual comment at the report's end, in which he bemoaned the commission's refusal to consider Dam's relation to the, quote, unjust and destructive dominant development model, unquote, globalization. Of the commissioners, MEDA was the best known, most outspoken, the most politically sharply defined, yet against all the odds, she was the most admired and in a certain way cared for. Now, let me go to a very different personality, Thayer Scudder, in Africa. Professor Thayer Scudder, the world's leading dam resettlement expert, did not want to go with me to Zambia. More precisely, he did not want to accompany me to Mzulu, the village in Zambia where for nearly a century he'd chronicled a social catastrophe set off by a dam. At its completion in 1959, the dam, an artless slab of arched cement named Kariba, rose the equivalent of a 48-story building above its Zambezi River floor. It was then the biggest dam in Africa and formed the world's largest reservoir, which instantly became the world's largest man-made thing. Kariba is the first large dam financed by the World Bank, which lavished on it the largest loan in the first decade of its history. From the air, the reservoir resembles a giant caterpillar with tributaries for legs. It obliterates 175 miles of upstream river and an average of 10 miles of terrain on either side. On that alluvial soil, enriched with sediment born from Africa's core, the Tonga of the Gwembe Valley had survived for thousands, perhaps hundreds of thousands, of years. To make room for the reservoir, the dam's British colonial builders uprooted 57,000 Tonga, two-thirds their entire number, and forced them into resettlement sites on barren land. In 1956, before the dam was finished, Scudder spent nearly a year in Mzulu, conducting an anthropological study of its 6,000 citizens. In the 4.5 decades that followed, he paid 18 extended visits to them in their resettlement village, called New Mzulu. In the beginning, Scudder had no inkling that he would document a disaster. He believed in dams, even as he constructed miniature karibas and termite mounds to show Mzulu villagers how their land would be inundated. they reacted with what he called great merriment and disbelief at the thought that a structure 60 miles away could affect them. It wasn't until the mid-1970s, after the villagers had seemed to recover from the shock of resettlement only to founder, that Scudder realized his job consisted of charting the disintegration of Tonga culture. Now he calls involuntary resettlement the worst thing you can do to people other than kill them. In the spring of 2002, when I was proposing the trip, Scudder's Mzulu informants reported that village residents were demoralized and hungry, and Scudder lacked the stomach, or perhaps the heart, for a first-hand look. He said we could go to Lesotho, the tiny African kingdom where he was ending a 13-year stint as a consultant on a huge dam project. And we could visit Botswana, where he'd played a crucial role in stopping a dam that would have harmed the Okavango Delta, a Connecticut-sized puddle of astonishing wildlife. But at Mzulu, he said, there's little to see. I'd have to go there without him, and indeed I did. Scudder's distress was as much intellectual as emotional. It arose not just from watching villagers of long acquaintance suffer and die, though that registered. It was, in a way, more personal, more fundamental, because it ate at the assumptions on which his career in dams is based. Again and again, he admired a dam in plan, lent support to its construction as consultant, and then, after documenting its failures of implementation and its social and environmental damage, grew disillusioned. His disillusionment has spread to his frequent employer, the World Bank, for failing to enforce its own resettlement and environmental policies, but it stops at the threshold of economic development itself. The conflict in his mind pits the concept of development, in which he has always believed, against all the evidence he has gathered of its failures. If dams, the centerpieces in every development project that includes them, repeatedly fail to produce environmental stability or even a modicum of economic justice, then what is left of development? And if development fails, as it so spectacularly has in Africa, then what will fill the gap between rich and poor? What will prevent a billion or two of the world's poorest people from unrelenting suffering and hopeless, squalid death? For Scudder, a kind of Dag Hammarskjöld internationalist, a successful dam would confirm a worldview. At 71, he was still looking for one good dam. Finally, I wrote about Australia, the world's most arid continent, where this the River Murray flows through a kind of ribbon of water. To give you a sense of this river, although it's the 16th longest river in the world, its flow in 1 year is less than the Amazon's in 1 day. And that gives you an idea of the preciousness of water in Australia. Because so much water has been diverted, at the bottom of the river, right next to the mouth, there's a 9-mile-long lagoon called the Coorong, which used to be an absolutely extraordinary place where migratory birds came from as far away as Siberia, 7,000 miles away, and dined on the fish by the hundreds of thousands. Now, as a result of all these diversions and the impacts that they've had, and then the building of weirs along the River Murray, and then barrages very close to the mouth, the Coorong is increasingly saline. There is now about one-tenth of the fish that there used to be and one-tenth of the birds. It's virtually dead. The mouth of the river is now so weakened because there's so little flow reaching it that it threatens to close up with sand. And sand has come in and inundated the mudflats on which those birds ate in the lagoon. It's quite a disaster. I wanted to find someone who had lived along the lagoon, and indeed it was only the Aboriginals who had done that, and a man named Tom Trevorrow gave me a tour of the lagoon. Trevorrow is a member of the Ngurindjeri community, which once flourished in the Coorong and along 250 miles of the Murray Corridor. The Ngurindjeri comprised one of the largest of Australia's Aboriginal nations. Trevorrow belongs to the last generation of Ngurindjeri to grow up around the Coorong. The river is a living thing, he said. When you start interfering with it, everything dies. What's needed is a full-blown river restoration. Restore the life of the river, then you'll restore the lakes and the Coorong and everything that revolves around them. When we lived along the Coorong, he said, and camped in places from one end to the other, we had no problems getting a feed of ducks, a feed of fish, whatever we wanted. But we were taught the old way, to take only what we need. You could walk around and see the shape of a flounder in the sand, and you could spear it. You can't spear fish anymore because there are no more fish. You could go to an island soak and dig a meter down to a little well and get as much fresh water as you needed. Those soaks have dried up now. The Coorong was a mixture of salt and fresh water, but there was a distinct line between fresh and salt, and you knew where you'd catch saltwater fish and where you'd catch freshwater fish. Now the Coorong is very salty, and there's no mixing of the waters anymore. We went on a drive in my rented car along the lagoon's long northeastern edge. Here, halfway down the Coorong, past the still-functioning part of the estuary, the lagoon looked inert, a watery equivalent of the moon. Here were no birds, no fish, no trees, not even as much water as I'd expected. In some places, the Coorong's seasonal contraction left exposed broad swaths of salt-whitened lagoon bed, so smooth they looked polished. It was a bestiary without beasts, alluring but inanimate, cold and hard. Our last stop was at a crest overlooking the lagoon. Tavaro pointed in the distance to an area abutting the shoreline where stones had been piled on top of a reef to form a nearly perfect circle. It was an ingenious, effortless fish trap. When the tide rose over the stones, fish swam inside the circle, only to be snared as the water ebbed. A single tidal cycle could yield hundreds of fish. The site was near one of the Narindari's seasonal camps, which they visited for a few months out of the year. When they broke camp, they breached the wall so that no fish would be trapped in their absence. Now the trap contained nothing but a puddle. Piles of stone lay on either side of the gap in the wall, right where the Narindari had considerately placed them, perhaps not knowing it was for the last time. In the 7 or 8 decades since then, the Coorong has lost nearly everything, but the trap remains intact, as if awaiting the return of fish, the return of the Murray, the return of deep water. Finally, I'll just read you a short selection from the epilogue to the book. We erect dams assuming that they are eternal, as if they'll never topple over or be dismantled or fill with sediment or lose their financial rationale. Yet all dams will die. All that remains unknown is the manner of their passing, whether they will be drained and safely put out of operation, decommissioned in the lingo, or will, out of indifference or misjudgment or an act of war, collapse to the enormous peril of all beings downstream. Dams are, of course, loaded weapons aimed down rivers pointed at ourselves. They're proof of the gambling nature of the societies that build them. Imagine these dams in 500 or 1,000 years after their useful life has ended, when an earthquake from the fault line beneath Sardar Sarovar fractures it, or the bankruptcy of Zambia and Zimbabwe leads to Kariba's fatal neglect, or Three Gorges fills with sediment, or Katse gets too expensive to maintain. And when every one of them suffers from an altered hydrological regime as a result of climate change. Take your pick of mortal scenario. Cumulatively, they're more plausible than the assumption that mega dams will be successfully financed, adroitly managed, and properly maintained into perpetuity. Some dams will crumble into the basins from which they rose, while others may still be intact but no longer storing water, which instead runs over or through or around them. They'll be relics of the 20th century, like Stalinism and gasoline-powered cars, symbols of the allure of technology and its transience, of the top-down, growth-at-all-costs era of development and international banks, of the delusion that humans are exempt from nature's dominion, of greed and indifference to suffering. If there are tourists, then they'll circulate through the ruins as they now inspect the pyramids, awed by the structure's technological prowess and unimaginable cost. The people who lived around the dams will have been dispersed, of course, and their cultures shattered, and the rivers in their valleys may still be depleted. But the dam's ephemerality, not the rivers, will then be on display. There'll be reminders of an ancient time when humans believed they could vanquish nature and found themselves vanquished instead.
That was Jacques Leslie. He spoke about his recent book, Deep Water, The Epic Struggle Over Dams, Displaced People, and the Environment. Jacques Leslie was once a foreign correspondent for the L.A. Times. He left the paper and became a narrative nonfiction writer and author of The Mark, a war correspondent's memoir of Vietnam and Cambodia. Jacques Leslie says about his plans, "My intent now is to continue writing about the immense environmental and social consequences of humanity's heedless, headlong embrace of development." I recorded Jacques Leslie in Corte Madera, California, in December of 2006. Come back for part two of this program. You will hear from Patrick McCulley, the executive director of International Rivers Network. He is dispelling the myth that hydropower is environmentally sustainable and clean, and presents long-suppressed research that proves that reservoirs are major emitters of carbon dioxide. Visit TUC Radio's website at www.tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org for links in this story and more information. Please find a pen to write down a phone number for information on how to order a CD or audio tape of this talk. This program is also available as film on DVD. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations. Your CD, tape, or DVD order is our only support and is essential in keeping us on the air. Call us toll-free anytime at 877-TUC-TAPE for information on how to order. You can get your tape or CD or DVD on large dams and hydropower by mail or credit card by phone or on the web. Our toll-free phone number 877-TUC-TAPE translates into 1-877-882-8273. My name is Maria Gelöden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.